Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Governor Mike DeWine and state lawmakers are juggling the aftershocks of what the U.S. attorney has described as the biggest public corruption case in the history of Ohio. There are two big questions as we start the week. What is the future of House Speaker Larry Householder? Every top Republican has called for him to resign, but he has not, even though he faces federal charges and a possible prison sentence of up to 20 years if convicted. The next question, what happens to House Bill 6? That's the nuclear bailout law at the center of the scandal. A bill to repeal it could be filed today. The man who signed it, Governor DeWine, first said the law should remain in place. Then, a day later, said it should be repealed and replaced because the process of passing it was unacceptable.
That process, I believe, has forever tainted the bill and now the law itself. This policy, while the policy, in my opinion, is good, the process by which it was created stinks. It's terrible. It's not acceptable.
Lots to digest today, 6 days after this story broke. Joining us for our reporters' roundtable is Laura Bischoff, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Laura, welcome back to All Sides.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Also, Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Jesse, welcome.
Good to be here.
And Joe Ingles, reporter for Ohio Public Radio's State House News Bureau. Joe, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be here.
Laura, we'll start with you. You're the one who broke this story, sent everyone scurrying last Tuesday morning when you had word that he was being charged, the House Speaker was being charged, and the federal agents were showing up at his farm in Perry County. What is the latest with his position, Larry Householder's position, as the Speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives?
Well, there's some competing camps within the House. I think everyone recognizes that they need to remove Larry Householder as the Speaker, debatable as whether or not they would actually expel him from his legislative seat. Expelling takes two-thirds majority vote, which is 66 votes. Removing him from legislative leadership takes 50 votes. The Republican caucus, they have a supermajority, but there's factions within the caucus. Some people are backing Bob Kupp, who is a state representative from Lima, former Ohio Supreme Court justice. Others are backing Jim Butler, who is currently the Speaker pro tem and Householder's number two guy. I'm hearing that Rick Carfagna, a Republican from Westerville, is interested. So there's, I think there's a meeting tomorrow of the Republican members to kind of hash out how to remove Householder and who to put in his place. I wouldn't be surprised if Speaker Householder, you know, shows up at that caucus and makes a case for keeping his position.
Well, that would be incredible. So there's no, he's given no indication, Laura, that he plans to step down. Now, the last time this happened, Cliff Rosenberger wasn't even charged, but they raided his house and he was under investigation and he quickly resigned and just, you know, left the state house. But there's no indication Larry Householder is going to do that.
Right. And the thing is that the Rosenberger investigation is still underway, according
yes.
to the FBI, as of last week when I checked with them. But Cliff Rosenberger has not been charged with anything. It's been more than 2 years since he stepped down and since the feds raided his house and his storage unit. So now Ohio has two speakers under current FBI investigation.
Interesting. Jesse Balmert, I mean, it's frankly not surprising that Larry Householder didn't immediately resign. It's just his nature is he's a tough politician, plays hardball. He's not been convicted. He, at least as of right now, plans to fight it out.
Yeah, correct. If the federal complaint and affidavit is to be believed, he helped perpetrate a nearly $61 million plot to get the speakership and help pass House Bill 6 and then prevent House Bill 6 from being blocked by a referendum effort. So I suppose if you did all that work, you probably want to keep the role that got you there.
Yeah. Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Will Republican lawmakers really vote to remove him from the speaker's chair?
Oh, I think going into an election year, they're worried about being able to get reelected, those who are up for reelection. You know, and so right now we see a lot of these Republican lawmakers going out of their way to distance themselves from him. And if there is a vote, if you remember the last time that when they had the vote to put Larry Householder in there in the beginning, it was because he was able to get some Democrats to cross over and vote for him. Though that Democratic support is not there right now. And so you would have to have even more Republican lawmakers in his corner. And that's just, it's not likely to happen at this point because the Republicans are also trying to distance from him.
We're talking about the scandal that has erupted at the State House in the past week with our reporters and during the Reporters Roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher, Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Jesse Balmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Joe Engels from Ohio Public Radio. Laura, there's still a lot of questions about this case. Are there other charges coming? Do we any word that other folks could be named in a future complaint or a future indictment?
Well, if you read through the 82-page complaint, which was authored by FBI Special Agent Blaine Wetzel, it has a whole bunch of pseudonyms for other players, associates, companies, you know, PACs, representatives, et cetera. And so I think, you know, there's a chance that some of those folks might get charged, but it's really unclear at this point. And, you know, keep in mind, like, this was a covert investigation that, as far as I could tell, like, they were recording conversations as far back as January of 2018. And I think that they, you know, there very well could be a lot more to come on this. But this initial complaint is, you know, it's a whopper. It's really pretty stunning. All the allegations and the idea that this dark money was the vehicle for all this bribery is kind of interesting and may have a chilling effect on how 501c4s are used in the future. I'd also like to say that, you know, these are allegations.
Yes.
In the complaint, and the government has to prove them in court, and we haven't. You know, we haven't heard too much from the defense attorneys yet because I think that they were hit with a complaint at the same time that they were, you know, called by their clients. So, you know, we'll see what kind of defense that they put up against it.
Yeah, I mean, as you well know, Laura, you just mentioned Cliff Rosenberger. He was investigated. There haven't even been charges there. Larry Householder was investigated before, you know, back in the early 2000s, 2004-ish. No charges were ever filed there. We had the Redflex scandal here in Central Ohio with the cameras. Allegations to conviction can be a long process. And I can see the defense. I mean, you even have a hint of it from Neil Clark, the lobbyist who is cited in the complaint as well, that he says that he got legal opinions during the campaign and during the process of passing HB 6 that what they were doing was okay. I can just see them saying, you know what? This is hardball politics, even dirty politics, perhaps even unethical politics. But under the system we have set up with these dark money groups, it's not illegal. Jesse, could you see that as their defense?
Yeah, I think that's certainly going to be something that's going to be brought up. The U.S. attorney said last week, to your earlier point, that the investigation is ongoing and that they're looking at additional individuals or so forth. So I think there could certainly be more coming from this. But as far as the defense, there are a lot of ways to move money in politics. These 501c4s, which commonly are called dark money groups because they don't need to disclose their donors. There were several of these that were used in this effort to kind of funnel money from places to other places. And that's allowed. PACs and even a for-profit corporation, which doesn't need to disclose very much money. So there was a lot of money going. I think on the other side of that, for example, Larry Householder allegedly used some of this money to pay off a lawsuit, allegedly used some money to repair a house in Florida, used some for his personal campaign. and obviously a lot of the people who are involved in this are named in the complaint and affidavit, received money for their services. So they are the federal investigators, and the U.S. attorney is going to try to say this money was given at a specific time for a specific purpose, and that's how you get to play to play.
Yeah.
Pay to play.
Yeah, using campaign donations for personal use is certainly a no-no. It's hard to defend that if there is clear evidence of that. Joe Ingles, as we know from the past year, if you think way, way back to January, quid pro quo, which is still hard to say, quid pro quo is hard to say and it's hard to prove. And we saw that with the impeachment of the president. We have seen in past cases, you know, this for that can be hard to prove, since there are legitimate arguments as to why HB 6 should have passed, and that is to keep a diverse energy system here in Ohio, to protect the jobs at these nuclear power plants. It can be hard to say, well, we only did it because we got $61 million.
Right, right. And you know, the way that politicians say quid pro quo is they just say pay to play, which is the same thing, essentially. But yeah, I mean, this is a very complicated bill. There were so many different things that went into it. I mean, we're talking the alternative energy part of it. They took the alternative energy regulations, guidelines that were in place, and turned those upside down in this bill. There were many pieces of it. And in order to get to where they got with the bill, they had to go through a lot of constituencies and make changes. And it was not an easy process by any means. And then the process that came after the bill was signed into law, where the groups wanted to repeal it, that was definitely convoluted, because they made it so convoluted. It was part of that, you know, there's a thing about voters. If you confuse voters, they tend to vote no.
Yeah.
If you try to keep them from getting anywhere, they'll, you know, if you keep these things off the ballot, you're better off. And you'll see lawmakers time and time again, look at medical marijuana. They came to a conclusion on that issue to try to keep it off the ballot, mm-hmm. and they did.
Yeah.
So it's convoluted all the way around.
Laura Bischoff, getting back to the possible future charges, you know, to have proof of a bribe, I'm not a lawyer, but to have proof of a bribe, you need to have both a briber and a bribee. Federal prosecutors in their complaint say the bribee was Householder, and they say the briber is Company A, which we are pretty certain is First Energy. So if a crime was committed, shouldn't the entity that wrote the check or transferred the money also be charged? But so far, nobody on the other side faces charges in this case.
Well, like I said, there's a lot of unnamed entities in that complaint. And First Energy did receive a subpoena and said it is cooperating with the investigation. You know, I wanted to go back to something that Jesse was talking about with the 501c4s. There are legitimate uses for them, but you're not allowed to coordinate.
Yeah.
And between the 501c4 and, you know, a campaign or a public official who might be benefiting from the messaging from that group. And in this case, the feds are saying that Generation Now was really wholly controlled by Larry Householder and his longtime political operative, Jeff Longstreth. And so, you know, in essence, they're saying this was a vehicle for First Energy to pay in a bunch of money to get Householder positioned into power. And then in return, he passed a $1.3 billion bailout bill, which was House Bill 6. And all that, you know, the money went into electing Householder and his team, and then passing the bill, putting on a pressure campaign in the House and in the Senate, and then dumping a lot of money in to, like Joe said, prevent it from going to the ballot.
When you think about it, Laura, these are allegations. We have to, again, reiterate that. But this is an incredible scheme. It's not just paying off lawmakers to vote a certain way. They had to get these lawmakers elected first. Then those lawmakers had to get their guy as speaker into office. I mean, It really was. I mean, Julie Carr-Smith wrote a story over the weekend about how Larry Householder always played the long game. This was a long game, if these allegations are true.
Yeah, that 82-page complaint, it opens up with the fact that householder flew on the first energy jet in January of 17, and the Dayton Daily, we did a profile of Householder in March of 17, and a tipster told me that Larry Householder and one of his sons rode on the jet to the Trump inauguration. And I asked him about that in the interview, and he said, I asked him if he was going to pay the money back or if he was going to claim it on his ethics statement. And he said he was awaiting an invoice from First Energy for the cost of that flight. He was close to First Energy, at the very earliest part of his return to the State House.
Yeah. It paved the way one way or the other. We'll come back. We'll talk about what's next as far as HB6, the nuclear energy bailout bill. Also, what's the future of these so-called dark money groups and what are the political ramifications of this scandal as we head into an election in November and then an election a couple of years from now when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Is there something you've always wondered about Columbus? Like,
how did Circleville get its name?
Does Columbus have an accent?
Are Ohio's highways based on American Indian trails?
How much has the NRA donated to Ohio lawmakers?
What happened to passenger rail in Columbus?
Curious CBUS is WOSU's series that investigates questions submitted by you, our listeners. What have you always wondered about Columbus? Submit a question you're curious about today at WOSU.org/curious.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about House Bill 6, the nuclear energy bailout bill, which, of course, is the center of the scandal that has rocked the State House, that's led to a criminal complaint against House Speaker Larry Householder and 1, 2, 3, 4 other people closely associated with the speaker. Our reporters here during our roundtable to dissect this, find out where we go from here as we start a new week, is Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Jesse Ballmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Jesse Ballmer, this whole campaign, if you think back to this whole thing, it was just, you knew there was something going on. I mean, we all knew as reporters that the campaign tactics were incredible. Remember the ads they were running saying this was a Chinese takeover. We had blockers trying to keep people from signing petitions outside of public libraries. We had reports of petition gatherers being paid to leave town, basically. So none of this was terribly shocking. Maybe we were surprised it was all black and white, but none of this, Jesse, was terribly, wow, I didn't see this coming. Is that the feeling of the State House?
I think a lot of people knew that this was shady. I don't know if they knew that it was potentially illegal. And part of the great thing about being the FBI is you can do wiretapping and you can subpoena records from organizations and so forth that reporters can't get. But I know myself and other State House reporters for years have been reporting on how some of this money has been moved around. Generation Now, which Laura mentioned earlier, was essentially Householder's 501c4 and how that was used in the ballot campaign. But there were even interesting tactics, like in July 2019, before this House Bill 6 was even signed, this operation was paying money to signature groups to stop them from helping the referendum to block House Bill 6. So they would pay petition signatures to not go against House Bill 6. So that was interesting. And obviously, listeners will remember the ads that said, don't give China your information. Those were very bombastic, and a lot of reporters wrote about those. But even the scheme shows how they tried to cover some of that money up, because those ads are paid for by Ohioans for Energy Security as opposed to Generation Now. So trying to put some distance between Generation Now and this ballot campaign.
Yes, we could all agree that this, the names here is just incredible. We have the Generation Now and these other groups, and then First Energy and First Energy Solutions. And frankly, I've been on vacation. I don't even know the name of the new company. What's the name of the new company that First Energy Solutions is now?
I think it's Energy Harbor Energy.
Harbor Energy. Can we all agree it's First Energy?
Energy Harbor.
I mean, I know they're subsidiaries and they're independent companies, but it's First Energy. They're certainly kissing cousins at the very least, if we can use that legal term. Jamie Colander, the state rep from Northern Ohio, who sponsored the bill, issued a statement this morning. He says he did not genuinely understand all the behind-the-scenes actions it took to pass the bill. That's quite an interesting denial. He said he was just looking out for the workers at the plants, but did not genuinely understand. Go ahead, Joe. Where is that?
Oh, sorry. This is Jesse.
Jesse, go ahead.
It's interesting because the two representatives that were selected to carry House Bill 6, Representative Callender and Representative Wilkin, were both members of this quote-unquote team householder, so people that householder spent money through his PAC and also just in general to help get them elected. And then he picked two freshman lawmakers to carry this bill, which was essentially a householder's bill. So those individuals might not have been aware of the whole thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to interrupt. Callender is listed as a freshman, but he's not a true freshman because he served in the House and I think in the Senate, more than a decade ago. So he is well aware of how the legislature works. Mm-hmm.
Yes, genuinely understand. That's a good legal defense there. Joe Ingles, where does the repeal of House Bill 6 stand? Governor DeWine first said that, you know what, as bad as it was, it's still a good bill because we maintain the nuclear power in the state, which we need for our diverse energy structure. It saved those jobs up there, the two plants. So he still supported the bill. But then a day later, he said, okay, wait a minute. It wasn't that good a process. We're going to repeal and replace it. Where does the repeal and replace of House Bill 6 stand right now?
Well, there's a lot of debate right now about what should happen. Should it be a complete repeal, or should they only repeal the nuclear bailout portion where they dealt with those two plants up there? There are four big portions of HB 6, four big agenda items that have been out there from First Energy for the last 10 years. And so they're going to have to look at all these pieces. The lawmakers are going to have to look at all these pieces, figure out how they want to put this together and structure it. They've got these jobs up there, that are tied with these nuclear power plants. So, what are they going to do about them? And by the way, are they going to bring back the alternative energy standards that were there? Because a lot of the environmentalists say that alternative energy was hurt greatly by HB6. So I don't know where it's going to go. I guess we'll all sit and watch.
Yeah, one of the to-do list items on my vacation to-do list last week was to look at one of those Nest thermostats, the automatic thermostats, and electric companies are offering a rebate if you buy one of those. Well, those rebates expire, I think, the end of September. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Because of House Bill 6. So if you're in the market for one of these rebates, you better act quickly. But that's an example of how this bill changed sort of the lives, ordinary lives of Ohioans. It means a slight reduction in our electric bills eventually. And also these rebates you get for appliances and electronic thermostats, smart thermostats, they go away. Jesse.
Yes. And another key timeline to keep considered when we talk about repeal and replace of House Bill 6 is starting in 2021, there's going to be a 85-cent fee on Ohioans' electric bills statewide that helps fund this First Energy bailout. And so if they want to repeal it before that takes effect, we presumably have to get on this in the next several months. But there's also the matter of figuring out who's going to be the Speaker of the House.
Yeah, Laura, the way legislation works, it's the speaker that allows bills to go forward. Larry Householder remains the speaker. I don't see him pushing for a repeal of House Bill 6. Am I wrong in that assumption? Laura?
You're correct, but I think I really do think that the GOP caucus will replace Householder as Speaker in the coming days. And then, you know, they have this matter of an election to deal with. And there's, I can't remember if it was Joe or Jesse said that, you know, there's, they're kind of in disarray. Like the, you know, they need somebody to step up and run the legislative district campaigns. And they have to elect a new speaker. And then, you know, now they have to deal with this repeal replace issue. And so it's really kind of a mess for the GOP caucus right now. And the other point I wanted to make is that, you know, we had that clip of the governor saying that the process by which House Bill 6 became law stinks. But, you know, to those of us who were covering it in real time, it seemed kind of smelly as it unfolded.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we talked about it all the time. I mean, just the ads and the campaign tactics was just, even after it became law, those were, you know, nobody had ever seen tactics like that before. And they were successful. They did. They
well, and the fact that they called it a clean, what was it, the Clean Ohio or Clean Air Act or clean something or other, that was a misnomer because really it was to bail out coal-fired plants and also the nuclear plant. And it didn't, it just, the whole thing was smelly from the get-go.
Oh, yeah, and there was a plant in Indiana that was covered by this. Mm-hmm. Granted, it serves Ohio and serves AEP, an Ohio company, but one of the coal plants we bailed out is in Indiana. So go figure that. It was just a really odd bill all the way around, and that's why I said it's surprising but not shocking, I guess, is the way to describe this whole situation. Jesse Baumert, the governor's office has not really been implicated in this so far, but he signed the bill. Was the governor's office genuinely unaware of what was going on behind the scenes, and might they also feel some blowback from this?
Well, there's a few layers of this. First off, the U.S. Attorney's Office has said that they are not investigating anyone from the DeWine administration. DeWine has said that he hasn't been contacted by the FBI. There is a connection to the DeWine administration that I reported on last week. One of the groups called Partners for Progress. It was a way for First Energy to send money to Partners for Progress, and then that money was sent to Generation Now and also Coalition for Growth and Opportunity. For 17 and 18, that was run by Dan McCarthy, who is now Mike DeWine's legislative director. McCarthy was a First Energy lobbyist at the time when he was president of that, what's being called an energy pass-through group. So I think that reporting came out about when Mike DeWine kind of said he was for a repeal and replace as opposed to being opposed to the repeal of House Bill 6. So that's interesting. McCarthy has said that he has not been contacted by the FBI mm-hmm. so far.
Interesting. God, there's so many names and so many tangents here. It really just sort of gives you an indication of how the behind-the-scenes politics of the State House works. It was all laid out in that 82-page document by the federal government, at least as far as this bill is concerned.
It is. Sorry, if I can interrupt
sure.
for a second. It is worth noting that at one point, DeWine was going to send, you know, the state plane to pick up lawmakers to vote on House Bill 6, and it's a bill that he signed within hours of it reaching his desk. So it was certainly something that the DeWine administration wanted to be enacted. Now, there's no allegation so far that they were aware of this whole operation, but it was something that they were supportive of.
Yes, very much so. Jesse Baumert, she's a State House government reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. She joins us today on our Reporters Roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Also joining us is Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio and Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News. Laura, you're a longtime observer, longtime reporter at the State House. The power of utility companies at the State House is probably unmatched. There might be other industries that have as much power, but not many industries have more power than utilities have at the State House. Does this case have any long-term effect on that power? Do you see that power diminished at all because of this case?
Probably for First Energy it does, but I don't know that utilities overall will have diminished power. They are really large companies. They serve every household and business in Ohio. So you know, they're ubiquitous, and I don't see that power being diminished. They do hire, it's like they have armies of lobbyists hired. And it's interesting, at one point I was looking at the list of lobbyists registered to lobby on House Bill 6, and it was over 100 people, not necessarily all for the utility. Some were for opposition groups, et cetera. But, it, you know, that bill got an enormous amount of firepower behind it.
And Joe Ingles, let's not forget, there was a lot of money on the other side as well. First Energy and its subsidiaries were fighting to pass HB 6 to bail out their two nuke plants and save them, you know, get them $1 billion. But the other energy sources, natural gas industry, other industry groups were spending a lot of money opposing it. And then they were starting to fund the repeal effort, and that didn't go anywhere.
Right, right. And you have the environmental groups out there who were definitely, you know, Sierra Club, those kind of groups were fighting against it. And they were providing a lot of their own manpower on that petition effort. You know, they were, had their own volunteers out there who were doing things as well as paid on that side. So, this had a lot, as Laura just said. I mean, if you look at who was involved in this, it's going to be a long list because that on both sides, you had a lot of heavy hitters.
Jesse Bowman, that shows why it's going to be incredibly hard to do this again. If you were to repeal House Bill 6 and scrap the law and scrap the bailout and go back to where we were, there were so many moving parts in getting this thing passed. That it would be incredibly difficult to do that again.
Yeah, right after the press conference where Mike DeWine said that he wanted to repeal and replace House Bill 6, I texted a few fellow reporters saying I didn't want to do this again. just because covering House Bill 6 the first time around was such a roller coaster of moving parts. And on its face, it is a very simple bill. The goal of this was to obtain $1.3 billion for two nuclear plants controlled by First Energy Solutions, subsidiary of First Energy, and it achieved that. That's where 93% of the money is going, according to the affidavit. But there's also some money for some solar plants. There's also two coal plants in there. There's also the changes to incentives for renewable energy and energy efficiency. And the way that they got some Republican lawmakers to sign on to this bill was to say, to, you know, make it a decrease in the bills for ratepayers. In order to do that, they had to get rid of these incentives for renewable energy and energy efficiency before they tacked on the fee for the bailout. And so it was complicated then. It's going to be complicated to change it. But that is what is, if that's the will of the legislature, it'll get done somehow.
And also, you know, we do have lame duck coming up. The 2-year legislative session ends at the end of December this year, and the period of time between election day and the end of the legislative session, that's lame duck, and they can accomplish enormous amounts of things in that time period.
It's amazing how efficient lawmaking can be during the lame duck sessions. Any chance Governor DeWine carries the flag for this? His approval rating is pretty high right now because of the pandemic. Does he have the political capital, if he does, support this bill for the reasons he says, the bailout of these two plants, the energy diversity for the state, the saving of the jobs? Could he be the person to carry the flag and replace this with a different bill?
Possible. One thing he did say at the press conference last week is that those workers at the nuclear plants, they don't know Larry Householder. They didn't, you know, this is completely unrelated to them and their jobs. And if these plants do close, it is going to have catastrophic effects for the communities in which they're based. So I think that is the argument that those supported House Bill 6 the first time are going to support this time. But it's Mike DeWine also is trying to deal with the novel coronavirus. We were going to look at police reform. We're coming up on the 1-year anniversary of the shooting in Dayton. We really haven't done much on gun solutions. So there's a lot on the plate right now.
Yeah, well, if those workers up there at those nuclear plants didn't know who Larry Householder was before last week, I think they may know who he is now, because their jobs now depend on him. When we come back, we'll talk about at least one of those other things that's on the plate, COVID-19. We have a mask mandate that's now statewide. The city of Columbus looks like it might shut down bars starting at 11 o'clock at night. We'll talk about that when the Reporters Roundtable continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. It's our weekly Reporters Roundtable where we try to wrap our arms around what's going to happen in the week ahead at the Ohio State House. Lots going on, as we've been hearing. Our guests today, Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Jesse Ballmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio's State House News Bureau. We do have a global pandemic that continues. It sort of got overshadowed a bit last week, but Ohio's cases continue to rise. We're up to 84,000 cases total since the pandemic began back in February. That's up almost 900 from Saturday to Sunday. So slightly less than we've been seeing, but it's still a lot of new cases between Saturday and Sunday. 3,307 Ohioans have died from COVID-19. And now Governor DeWine has once again ordered everyone in the state to wear a mask, and there's no indication, unlike the last time, that he's going to reverse himself on that. Joe Ingles, what prompted the governor to issue the statewide mask mandate, something he was very reluctant to do?
Well, you know, the more of the medical professionals have come out in the last month and said, hey, this is the best way. Even businesses are saying this is the best way to reduce transmission, that wearing a mask will definitely help keep those restaurants and bars open longer, not shut down government, and you know, just take the COVID crisis more seriously. And, you know, talking about those masks, it's like it's important that people realize that when you're wearing that mask, if you have two people, you're wearing it and someone else is wearing it, both people are getting coverage that way. And when you've got these bars and restaurants where servers are coming to your table and they're wearing masks, but you're not, you know, you can transmit it to them. They've only got one layer of protecting them, the one that they're wearing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we live here in central Ohio, and I think where I go, wearing a mask is near universal. It's very rare now in the past couple of weeks to see somebody who does not wear a mask at the grocery store or out in public, especially an indoor public area. But my wife and I went on a vacation to southeast Ohio this last week, and that is not mask-wearing territory down there. We stopped at a bar in Lancaster, for a brew pub in Lancaster, to just get a beer on the way down. We walked in with our masks. You'd have thought we were aliens, the looks we got from people who were inside the bar not wearing masks. The bartender was not even wearing a mask. We went outside after getting our beer, but it's a different world, Jesse, in some parts of the state, as far as how when it comes to wearing a mask and the acceptance of it.
I think so. I also think in your cities, like Columbus and Cincinnati, there have been some orders from mayors there. Dayton also had a mask order, so perhaps they've had a little bit more time to adjust to that. I also think just by nature of there being more people in your urban areas, there are more cases. And so I think in some parts of the state, you look at a handful of cases and you say, this isn't a concern in my community. But what the governor is really trying to get across is that there's community spread across the state and that this is something that could benefit all Ohioans and not just those who live in more densely populated areas.
Laura Bischoff, he got a lot of blowback the last time he tried to do this. In fact, he reversed himself a day later. Is he facing the political criticism from his own party, let's face it, from the far right of his own party for this mask mandate?
Oh, most likely he is. And I think it's because you know, people are the anti-mask group is largely from more rural areas and more conservative areas, and they are experiencing the pandemic in a different way than people in more densely populated cities are. And I think that, you know, to a large degree, a lot of those folks kind of take their lead from President Trump, who up until recently has refused to wear a mask. And the Trump administration really has kind of changed its tune in terms of, you know, mask wearing recommendations as the virus spikes in, you know, the Deep South and in areas that are really kind of Trump country.
Did the householder arrest give DeWine some political cover to order the statewide mask mandate? I mean, looking at the Republicans, I mean, DeWine is very popular amongst most people in the state. He's more popular among Democrats than Republicans in this way he's handled COVID. But his leading opponent to the whole mask wearing thing was Larry Householder. He didn't want House members or didn't require House members to wear masks. Staffers at the State House weren't required to wear masks. He gets arrested the next day. There's a statewide mask mandate.
Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Joe.
Sorry, I can't. I'm sorry about that. I can't see anyone, so I don't mean to trip over anyone. But, you know, the following day, after, you know, when he came out and we saw him go out to the car, Larry Householder had a mask on. That was the first time I've seen Larry Householder wearing a mask. How about you guys?
Oh, absolutely.
Correct. It's my understanding it's required in federal court, which is perhaps why he was wearing it. But it's also my understanding that there was a plan to announce a statewide mask mandate, but certainly most of Governor DeWine's most vocal opponents of masks have come from House Republicans, including sometimes the Speaker himself. And so with them very caught up in this whole investigation and finding a new Speaker, there's probably a lot less criticism than there would have been edgewise.
Yeah, it was a very ironic photo because Householder was pretty adamant that he didn't need to wear a mask. And here he is walking out of court after answering the charges wearing a mask. And it was certainly, at the very least, an ironic photo. The first thing I noticed is he was wearing a mask when he was so reluctant to wear one, to put it that way. Getting back to COVID-19 and what might be in store, the city of Columbus city council tonight seems poised to issue an order closing bars in particular at 11 o'clock at night, saying that's where the virus is being spread because people are not staying apart. They're not wearing masks as they're enjoying their adult beverages. Laura Bischoff, anything else coming from the state as far as further restrictions to try to slow the spread, or are they going to see how this statewide mask mandate works out?
You know, I'm not really sure. Maybe Joe or Jesse could speak to it, but I was completely consumed with the Householder case last week.
I can understand that. I took
my eye off of the coronavirus story for a little while.
Yeah, Joe or Jesse?
I tried to juggle all the plates last week. But
and your boss was on vacation.
Right now, that's not the plan. Governor DeWine was saying at his press conferences last week that they're really going to push, like, you know, the Ohio Investigative Unit is going to do investigations into bars that are bad actors, that aren't wearing masks, that are having people crowded together, and penalize those individuals accordingly. But the kind of widespread statewide, let's close all the bars that some other governors have gone to, he doesn't seem, at least right now, like that is his next step. And so I think the governor is perhaps less interested in restricting businesses than city council is right now.
Yeah. And, you know, in the governor's defense, and what the argument is, that it's worse in the cities, that people are more crowded together. The spread is more prevalent. The cases are more prevalent than they are, say, in Knox County or rural county in southern Ohio or western Ohio, where, you know, the spread just not there right now. Joe Ingles.
Right. And you know, one thing, I have ties in some of these rural counties. I'm from one of those. I live in another one, although Delaware County has rural parts and it has more citified parts, so it's kind of both. But, you know, one thing that we see up here is mass gatherings. Over the weekend, we were out and about, and we saw a few mass gatherings where people were going in large groups to a home to celebrate what looked like either a birthday or graduation parties. We've seen all that kind of stuff. And they're not wearing masks. I mean, people are not wearing masks. We see a lot of people going to church and they're not wearing masks. Or if they are wearing masks, they're being very nonchalant about it. We see, you know, we're talking about closing down these bars and restaurants at you know, 10 o'clock. And people might wonder, well, why 10 o'clock? Well, I remember from being a server in my youth, when you have these bars and restaurants, a lot of times they cut off the food service at, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, whatever time it is. And the people who are there later tend to be sitting around drinking, talking, socializing, getting more familiar with each other, you know, louder. So that's why there's this move to maybe restrict the bars and restaurants past a certain time. But those are the kind of things that we're seeing, you know, right now, where there's these big mass gatherings of people. And there's some, you know, some of the experts are saying that's where they're seeing a lot of infections. So if they can keep that down and keep people wearing their mask, they think that this has a shot of going down considerably.
Yeah. One of the reasons the governor mentioned for the statewide mandate is there's some evidence that the counties that did have the mandates, there were, I forget how many are they right now, but there were over a dozen counties, 60% of the state's population fell in these counties where masks were mandated. And in those counties, Franklin County being one of them, they started to see some improvement, some slowing of the spread of coronavirus in those counties where masks were mandated. So that was one of the reasons why the governor cited for why he imposed that statewide mandate. The big question now is schools. You know, we're coming up on the 1st of August. We see the back-to-school ads in the Sunday paper when we get it. We see them on television. Jesse, what is the status of schools right now? Are we just sort of waiting for the next couple of weeks to see how the cases go, how the spread goes?
A little bit. Governor DeWine and his administration has really given authority to make decisions about school districts to the local school boards. And so what you might see happening in Cincinnati public schools will be different than Columbus public schools or Cleveland or a more rural school district. I know in Cincinnati, the current game plan is to have students in person 3 days and then online 2 days and then kind of swap that the next week, 2 days and 3 days. So that's one method. There are other school districts in the suburbs of Columbus that are tying it to the color-coded map that the governor has been putting out. So if you reach purple, maybe all of the classes, which is the most serious level, maybe all of the classes go to online. So there are pros and cons to everyone in the state doing something a little bit different, but school districts are getting creative about what they think they can achieve.
Yeah, all that creativity puts parents in a bind because they try to make plans of what they're going to do come fall, and daycares aren't fully reopened yet. Joe Ingles, it's going to be an interesting month to see how you know, K through 12 schools handle it, and let's not forget universities start coming back in mid-August as well, and how they handle the reopening.
Yeah, and there's a tremendous push at the university level to get those kids, those students in the classrooms versus being online. Because let's face it, if you're online, why would you want to pay the big money to be in a university if you're taking online classes? So, and a lot of parents just want their kids to have that traditional college experience, you know, where you actually go away and you live on your own and, you know, you learn a lot. There's a lot to be learned through that. And so all of those things are going into consideration of reopening colleges. But at the same time, the ones that are, you know, we've seen some of these sports practices and stuff, and they've been having problems with COVID. And some of the smaller colleges in the state have said no fall sports whatsoever, just because they don't feel like they can keep the COVID at bay.
Yeah, we're watching now. I mean, baseball just began this weekend. The NHL starts, I think, next week. The WNBA has begun. MLS, the soccer, has started to pick up their games, their tournament. Lord Bischoff, this will be an interesting – sports could be a good barometer as to how schools can reopen safely, if they can reopen safely, if it can't keep athletes from catching it from one another in the limited venues that they're in, it's going to be hard for college campuses to keep their, you know, putting students in dorms to keep them
apart. Oh,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, there's sort of a discussion about how you can't get kindergartners and first graders to socially distance, but I have two kids in college and I don't see a lot of social distancing happening in their age groups. you know, I think that you put them into the dorms or you put them on campus, and they're gonna hang out, and that's part of the college experience, part of the campus experience. And what I think is interesting is a lot of parents are kind of assessing, do they send their kids to college to get that college experience, but then risk COVID and also at the same time be paying tuition for classes that are largely held online. So, you know, I think the colleges are in a bad position, and I think you're right, the big problem with sending K-12 kids back in some sort of a hybrid system is that it, you know, working parents are just, you know, at a loss of how to manage the logistics.
Yeah, it's going to be another interesting week between what happens with the Larry Householder situation, what happens with COVID-19, that certainly continues, and we'll be watching it here on WOSU. My thanks to Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News, Jesse Ballmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann Fisher on All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News.